Good evening. Today
Radio.
Good
Welcome
evening.
To Tribal Today Wisdom Radio, your marriage support network. Tune in for all things love, marriage, and family. We are devoted to love. Here we go.
Good evening. Today is January 7th, 2015, and this is Tribal Wisdom Radio. My name is Makaysha Dorsey. I'm sitting in for Cynthia. Happy New Year. We have a great show lined up for you tonight. Our first guest is Barbara McNally, author of Unbridled. And our featured guest is Kristen Mitchell, author of He Wasn't My Daddy. I'm sitting in tonight for Cynthia to give her a break, and so that the show won't have to take a break because she's taking a break. Tonight we'll be discussing relationship resolutions. How will you transform your relationships in 2015? Some of the things that we will look at tonight are how women get lost in relationships. We'll discuss that with Barbara McNally. You're going to really love her story. I learned about Barbara while I was working on some articles for Bridal Tribe magazine. And when you hear her speak about her experiences being married and the things she's learned from being married and her journey after marriage, you will be inspired to make some personal changes in your life. She'll talk to you about being lost in other people, about how to find yourself. And another great thing about Barbara is that her story is dynamic, and she's taken her situation and she's even started a foundation for women as well. It looks like I might have someone on the line. Is this from a 619 number? Would you like to come on the call?
For McNally.
Hello. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, this is Barbara McNally. Thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, it is so great to talk to you again today. I am so excited. First, can you start by telling us a little bit about yourself? Because I don't think I did you justice.
Well, I wrote a midlife memoir that's a slice of my life. We say it's a piece of pie, a memoir is. That's different than a biography. It's just a part of life. And the part of life for me was an existential crisis in starting out on my own to gain my independence, find out who I am, and give back to the world. And it's a fun travel memoir where I go back to Ireland, my roots, and then Jamaica, a fun travel memoir for you.
Wow. Okay. So we have Ireland and we have Jamaica. Can you tell me the one thing that you learned when you went back, when you went to Ireland, the beginning of your roots? What did you learn about yourself there?
Well, I think all of our listeners can relate is that when I went back to my roots from whence I came and found strong women role models in my background from the Celtic culture of Ireland, and I a bit romanticized the Irish culture in that their love for freedom, their rebellion in that their country's never been taken over, and their strength. And I found all those qualities within me being Irish. And for the listener out there, maybe you can go back to your roots. If you can't travel all the way to your home country, you can still study women in your past that have inspired you, and that's where I found my strength.
Wow. Okay, well, you went back to your roots. What prompted you to leave Ireland and then decide to make a trip to Jamaica? And what did you learn about yourself while in Jamaica?
Well, in Jamaica, it was, we go to most divorcees or singles want to go have some fun. And I went as a prude to a Hedo beach in Jamaica. And destiny had another plan for me. I was on my taxi broke down at an orphanage in Jamaica. And there I found girls that were totally imprisoned. They had no choices in life. And that made me realize that a lot of my choices, I was the prisoner, I held the key, and I was also the person that could free me. So I learned a lot from those girls as they were truly prisoners, and I actually wasn't being in America. And just bringing them a bit of heaven on earth, riding horses with them and working with them, I felt a great high from helping others. So when I came home, I started a foundation to help in my own backyard in San Diego. It's called Mother Lover Fighter Sage, to help women find their personal freedom.
Yes, and I've read your website. I've actually ordered your book. You have Mother Lover Fighter Sage, and can you explain the name to those of us who haven't been to your website?
Well, great. Yes, if you Google Barbara McNally or Unbridled Freedom, you can find my website. But with you're talking about New Year's resolutions, and all of us women, hopefully, we have some New Year's resolutions, because if we don't have a plan, then we fail to plan, and then we have failure. So the
yes.
archetypes are the kind of our inner plan. So my grandmother introduced these to me, and that's part of the reason I went back to Ireland. But these have been around for ages. Archetypes are just patterns that give us power. So the mother is the nurturing, healing, empathetic side of a woman. The lover is the passionate, playful, sensual, creative side of a woman. The fighter, the assertive, goal-driven side of a woman. And the sage, the intuitive, spiritual, wise side of a woman. So for myself, I was looking at these and how can I balance them, because my life was out of balance at one time, and my journey is to balance these so that I can use them in powerful ways to create the life I want.
And, you know, balance is really important. I think a lot of the times as women, we get caught into the primary role. Sometimes we'll get caught up into our mothering role, the lover role, and then we fight. You know, what are some ways that women can find balance in between these roles and be able to jump from one to the other while maintaining who they are?
Well, exactly. We want to live integrated life. So the best way is if we can, you know, and we can have to integrate these. I myself was one-dimensional, just the mother role, and I let the lover, that playful, passionate, sensual, creative side of a woman die. I let the fighter die. I quit my career. I just was a submissive housewife, and I didn't listen to my inner voice, that sage, that inner wisdom. So my other, even though I enjoyed being a mother, there was more to me, and these other dimensions came out at first in unhealthy ways. So the lover, you know, I was cheating on my husband. The fighter, you know, more of a bitch than actually setting boundaries. On the sage, I wasn't listening to my inner self. So as a New Year's resolution, since that's our theme, maybe the audience can pick one that they feel like is lacking in their life. Or like you said, if one's just dominating, we're just the mother, and these others might be coming out for the audience too in unhealthy ways. How can we get these others to come out in positive ways so that we have a more integrated life and a healthier, more powerful life? So I don't know what you're feeling about.
Well, I actually like that you mentioned fighter. Again, I think so many women, we get caught up into whatever dominant role we have. You know, when we first get married, we're focused on being a lover. Or when we come out of college, we're focused on being a fighter. As we get older, we do lean towards the wisdom, the spiritual side of ourselves. But one role that really can take over a lot of women after they get married as mother. And you mentioned that you gave up your career, you became a submissive housewife, and just listening to you talk, that might have been unfulfilling. And one of the things that I've tried to do in my marriage is to keep my skills up, to stay active in the community. What are some things that women who make a decision to go into the role of being a housewife, how can they not get lost into mother and still maintain lover, fighter, sage?
Exactly. I'm all for women staying home. That's the wonderful freedom in America, is we can, women have the choice. So as far as a feminist, if anything, I say I'm a sexy feminist, because I think what a woman wants to embrace, you know, that's their choice. What I mean by singling out the mothers, even as a stay-at-home mom, I could have still kept the fighter going by having goals, whether it could be volunteering in the community, that we still, even if we're a stay-at-home mom, we don't have to give up that fighter, that assertive, goal-driven side, to still have goals, even if, you know, then you may not be working outside the home. The lover, I gave up the passionate, playful, sensual, creative side. That doesn't have to go whether we're working or not. Just, we just sometimes get beat down and we're like, oh, we don't have the energy, you know, to be playful and sensual. And we forgot what we used to love to do as a child. So to keep that up makes us a better partner too. So I'm not, I mean, all, for all you audience out there, yes, I'm not, the old-fashioned way is, you know, we can have it all juggling. I'm not saying anybody can have it all, but we do have the freedom to choose the path we want. And that's the important part. So if we want to be a stay-at-home mom, we can still keep these others going. And if we want to work, you know, then that's just taking on another challenge, but it's taking it to another level, don't you think?
Right. Right. And I think that's so important to keep the fighter alive, because I always tell my friends and my aunt and my mother, they told me, your husband leaving you or you leaving your husband is not necessarily the worst thing that can happen in a relationship. Your husband can go out of the house, get hit by a car, and is in a wheelchair for the rest of his life, and he may not be able to maintain his career. So keeping your skills up by volunteering, by taking on a contract once every other year or so, or even keeping up your certifications in whatever field you're in, can actually help keep part of that fighter in you, keep that assertive, goal-driven side. And I think a lot of the times when we get lost in motherhood, we're not around people who can pour into us, and we lose our sense of wisdom, and it causes us to lose everything about us, and we get lost. Now,
exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, well, because it's on New Year's, setting and reaching goals. I'm glad you're kind of really focusing on the fighter, and that's an Irish term. I think in America we call it more the warrior. But it's, yes, for women out there, we want, all of us want to set goals and achieve them, because that builds our self-confidence. It builds. And then we are better partners. We're more interesting. We have a life of our, we have a life of our own, because the men are going out and learning and growing. And we, whether we're stay-at-home or working, that's an important part to keep going to for future coupling, even if you're single out there.
Yes. And during the process of doing some research on you, I had a chance to interview you for Bridal Tribe magazine and for my own personal blog, and I took the 7 keys to making yourself happy that you gave us, and I thought it was such a good thing. And one of the things you mentioned was setting and reaching goals, but you also mentioned living an honest life, and that really struck me, because a lot of the times we think we're living an honest life and we're not. One of the things, I have a confession to make, everybody gets to hear it. One of the things I know for me, I've been having a struggle with my weight. And although I've been dieting and doing certain things, I'd have cookies hidden, I'd put cupcakes on top of the armoire in our bedroom. And we may look at that as being something really small, but it's a deception. You're lying to the people around you. You're supposed to be working out. You're supposed to be changing these habits, but you're not. And one of the things that you said in the interview is that deception drains a person's spirit. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, from personal experience, I hope you'll still, my story is a bit of a redemption memoir, but yes, I started out deceptive, little things, lying on the checkbook, lying where I was, you know, and it did lead, I did have an affair, which I do regret. I don't regret leaving the marriage. I regret the way I did it. And mm-hmm. kind of like alcoholism, it hurts. It's hurtful to others, and it's also hurtful to self. So I talk about honesty in that we have to have honesty in a relationship, but we have to also be in a relationship that we can be honest. So if we're having to lie about the checkbook, that's a sign that we're not, maybe there's a problem in the marriage right there, you know, that maybe you know, because a lot of kids will cheat on tests, right, because they want to please their parents and they're afraid to be honest, you know. So the same
right.
thing, it's a patriarchal marriage that you can't be honest with your boss who is your husband. That's just not a good setup. So I'm all for marriages. I'm just against bad marriages.
Exactly.
Honesty is important in a relationship, and I discounted it. I was taught growing up that, oh, you know, forgiveness is better to ask for than permission. And not really. To have a good relationship, we have to be with somebody, we can be honest with. And if we can't be honest that we want to go work out or we want to go to Jenny Craig or we want to go get our master's, if we have to lie about those things, you can imagine where that lie is going to go.
Exactly. Now, you talked about, now, in the whole deception part, you did bring up some things that a lot of women want to do. They want to go back and get a master's. They want to join Jenny Craig. They want to do these things, but sometimes they're either afraid to go to their spouse or they feel like they'll fail, so they keep it inside. And during our interview, one of the things that you said was to find something you love to do. How can women who are caught up in marriage, caught up in motherhood, how do they go back to themselves and say, hey, you're a person, what do you like?
Well, yeah, it's difficult to get out of, to keep care of ourselves. But I say if we're going to keep care of others, we have to keep care of ourselves. Just like a mother has to eat well and rest in order to breastfeed. And they say on the airplane, you know, put your oxygen mask on yourself first. So the expressing the lover is not just sexual, but it is sexual. Mm-hmm. It's our central creative side. Find something that turns you on, whether it's gardening or dancing, because that's restoring to us so that we can be a good partner. And I think men do it easily because, you know, they have their golf game or they play basketball. And it's okay. I mean, we want to support men to do the same. And women, sometimes their outlet is shopping, and that's not really, that's just preparing for an event. But find something you love to do. What revitalizes you? And maybe it's yoga, but it's important to keep that because otherwise we can't be good mothers and good partners. So skip the guilt and somehow we need to fit it in. And that goes into the fighter. We need to negotiate for that time that we are given that time.
Right. And you said, you mentioned guilt. And I think a lot of women carry that. I mean, even when I'm on the treadmill in the morning for 30 minutes, I'm on the treadmill thinking, you know, instead of being on this treadmill, I could be washing dishes or there is a load of laundry in the dryer. We're thinking about all of those things. But I think a lot of the times, as women, we're taught to give up so much, and men are fierce in going for what they want. Another thing in the interview, when I had a chance to interview you, you mentioned accepting yourself. And I think that's so hard for women to do because if we say, hey, I need you home 3 nights a week so I can go work out, you're trying to be yourself, but then there's that guilt. What are some things women can do to get past that guilt so they can accept themselves, accept what they want to do, while taking care of that mind-body connection?
Wow, that's a big question. How do we give ourselves permission? And I think I'm not pushing the book, but yeah, that's kind of my journey to give myself permission to keep care of myself. I think because I came from a people pleasing where I wanted everybody to like me, and if I was dishonest, everybody liked me because I put myself out that I was this perfect housewife and I would, you know, everything was perfect. And the problem is none of us are perfect. And I had to accept my imperfections and realize I had this strength within me to be an independent woman. I guess that is a huge thing. How do we give ourselves permission to keep care of ourselves? Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Yeah, and maybe every woman needs to ask that. Am I deserving to keep care of myself? Am I deserving to have goals and have a life being as important as my spouse or my kids? Otherwise, you know, we die inside. We live out just the mother and every other part of us dies. And part of that's like you said, you know, keeping care of yourself, finding something you love to do, because sometimes food is our only comfort. It's kind of like, well, you know, I work so hard, I'm going to eat a cupcake, and maybe there's another way to live that out, you know, besides having the glass of wine or the cupcake or the affair. I mean, there's healthier ways to live out that lover, the passionate playful,
right,
creative side. Yeah.
Right, right. And the last two things that you mentioned was finding a quiet time to recharge, and I think that goes back to giving yourself permission. What are some ways that women can steal a few moments a day to recharge?
Well, for our audience out there with little kids, it may just be a long shower. I sponsor Spa Day for the Wives of Wounded Warriors, and I have noticed when the women come, many of them say, I can't leave. This is the first time I've left my children, and I've left my husband, who's lots of times in the hospital at the time. They feel so mm-hmm. guilty for leaving. But it's the first step. It's just a tiny step. We provide child care for the children, and we provide somebody to sit with their spouse's bedside so they can come get a massage, have lunch, talk to other women who are going through the same thing. And that's part of the baby step permission. Because it's a sponsored program, that they, mm-hmm. they're less guilty to leave their family. And when they come, they tell me, I've never left my kids, I've never left my husband. But I say, well, you did it today, and when they go back home, they find out everybody survived, and then next time it will be a little easier. There is a lot of guilt to leave our spouses and our children and or whoever we're caretaking for. But it's important. And, well, so all of you out there, yeah, lots of times people are afraid. So just take one baby step. Maybe it's hiring a babysitter for an hour, and you're still in the house, so you can keep an eye on things. And you can go take a shower or a bath and relax. So it's there's baby steps to let cut that umbilical cord and know that your kids and your husband will survive without you.
I love the way that you're giving women a way to get some time to recharge by absolutely giving to others. It seems like you're one of those people who practices what she preaches. You've taken your experience, you've found something you're passionate about, and you're giving to others. It's so exciting to see someone taking the time to really serve the wives of the wounded warriors, because I think a lot of the times in military families, the military spouse, you know, they're in the spotlight. They get the attention. They're getting the medical care, and the person who's right there struggling alongside them and being that one-on-one support, a lot of the times they're left in that caregiver role to help. Can you please tell us how we can donate? Give us all of your online information before you go, and let us know some of the things that you have going on so that we can support you.
Oh, well, awesome. Well, if you do buy Unbridled through Amazon or just Google Unbridled Freedom, all the proceeds of the book go to the foundation. And the primary focus right now is the Wives of Wounded Warriors. And you can see all the other organizations I support. Or you can make a direct donation to the foundation. Or you can even just look at my website and be inspired to But keep care of yourself. On Monday, it's Marry Yourself Monday, so ways of healthy self-care. Wednesday, it's Women to Watch, so that's inspirational women that you might see that, gosh, you know, they inspire me that I can be whatever your dream is. And then Friday's Payback Friday. So if you go to the website, Google Barbara McNally or Unbridled Freedom, and for starting out this new year, wherever you want to be the co-author of your life or you want your life to go, I want to inspire you to get there. And the happy part is, yeah, giving back is a thrill too. And that's not all I do. You're right. It's keeping care of ourselves and keeping care of others makes it a fun life.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Barbara. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for interviewing me, and I look forward to talking to you soon.
All right, Barbara, thank you. Have a great evening.
You too. Bye now.
Bye. Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Barbara. She is such a gracious person. Right now, we're going to move right on over into our interview with Kristen Mitchell. She's the author of He Wasn't My Daddy, and she has a story for you. She wrote a book about it, too. So without further ado, let's meet Kristen. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, Makaysha.
How are you this evening?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I am good. The first time I had a chance to meet you was on Miss Ella's show, and
yes.
I was really inspired by you, really inspired by your story and the things that you have going on. And right now, we're discussing resolutions in the new year for women, and I think it's important to get a single woman's perspective on love, life, and marriage, because everyone comes into any relationship without baggage, baggage. Everyone
has
baggage, and it's how you carry that baggage. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and about your book?
Sure. So I'm Kristen Mitchell, and I wrote a book called He Wasn't My Daddy, My Road to Restoration and Redemption. And the book is a memoir about my life, and I talk about several different platforms in the book. And some of them are being a fatherless daughter, suicide prevention, mental illness, specifically depression. And I talk about those things because I suffered from depression for years as a result of a relationship gone bad, basically. And I couldn't figure out what the problem was. I didn't understand why this relationship had me in a place where I didn't want to live anymore. I attempted suicide twice. And as a result, I was hospitalized about four different times. And this all spanned over the course of about 5 to 6 years. And so in the book, what I do is I kind of bring the story full circle so that the reader can kind of discover what it was within me as to why I feel like I suffered through such a bad depression. And the fatherless daughter's piece comes in there because I realized that I was looking to a man for the love and the support and the validation that I should have gotten from my father figure who wasn't there at the time. And so discovering this forced me actually to start to mend that relationship with my father and so that I could, you know, heal certain parts of myself that I didn't even know were broken at first. Another big thing I talk about in the book is promiscuity. And there's a chapter in the book, it's chapter 8, and I won't give too much of it away, but I think just about everybody who's read the book has been very inquisitive about chapter 8 because it's quite juicy to say the least. But I put that in the book because, and again, I'm not going to say what it is because I don't want to give away too much, but I put it in the book because I wanted people to see just how far your emotions can take you in a negative way, you know, not having that father figure, looking for that love in all the wrong places, wanting to feel loved, wanting to feel validated because I wasn't at a place where I could validate myself. And so I looked for that from other people. And I use sex as a way to fill that void. And so I talk a lot about that in the book. And like I said, it comes full circle. And so by the end of the book, you're able to kind of see where I was when I finished writing the book, the help that I was able to get, the relationships that I've been able to mend. And I know tonight we're talking a lot about relationships, and my book is all about relationships, but not just one type of relationship, which is what makes it so great. It's not one-dimensional, you know. It's definitely multidimensional. Talk about relationships with your parents, relationships with your siblings, relationships with your friends, intimate relationships. So it's definitely a catch-all, and it's a book that I think every woman can relate to. So I received a lot of positive feedback from it, and it's helped a lot of people to begin their own healing process. So that's pretty much the quick and dirty about my book.
That's the quick and dirty. And one of the things tonight as we talk, I want to discuss certain aspects of your book, but I want to talk about you. And I want to delve into fatherless daughters, then into depression, then into suicide prevention, because so much is going on in the world right now. Even right. with those three items, I think you have every demographic on the planet covered.
Right.
Because for I think a lot of the times we assume that fatherless daughters are just daughters who are whose father isn't in their life, but a lot of the times mm-hmm. a father can be present, can live 15 minutes away from you, he's in and out, or he can live in the same house with you and not
exactly.
necessarily foster a relationship. So can you
exactly.
Tell me some of the traits of a fatherless daughter?
Absolutely. So, and I'm glad you brought up that point. And actually, I updated a Facebook post not too long ago that came from one of Ayanna Von Zant's teachings, and she talked about fatherless daughter. She and Oprah has a huge platform around fatherless daughters. And so it was important to note that a lot of people think that, oh, my father was in the home, so I'm not fatherless, you know. But when you talk about the lack of emotional stability, you can be a fatherless daughter in that sense. You know, your father lives there. He and your mother share the same bedroom, those type of things. But you can't go to him for anything. He's not there for you emotionally. He doesn't know how to connect with you as his daughter. And that's the story for some people, you know. Or your father lives in the same house with you, and he provides for your family, but he's never home because he's always working, so you never got to build that relationship with your father. To me, mm-hmm. being a fatherless daughter is all about not having a relationship with your father. And we cannot have a relationship with our father for any number of reasons. Death, the father just simply being physically absent, the father being emotionally mm-hmm. absent, the father being mentally absent. So, you know, there's tons of ways that you as a woman can become a fatherless daughter. And that affects you in so many ways. In the book, I talk about how it affects your decision-making when it comes to relationships with the opposite sex, and that was a huge one for me. The mm-hmm. book is titled He Wasn't My Daddy because I'm speaking about a relationship that I had with a guy who was 17 years older than me. And mm-hmm. after my fourth hospitalization, I was in a psych ward. I'm from D.C., so I was here in the D.C. area, and I was in the Virginia Hospital Center, and it's a chapter in the book about that. And I speak in detail about each of the times that I was in a different psych ward. And I do that because I want readers to understand what it was really like to be in that state mm-hmm. of mind. But mm-hmm. not to get too off topic, I speak about how not having a father kind of made me look for those things that a father would typically provide for you in this guy who was 17 years older than me, you know, and his name is, you know, his name is in the book, and I talk about it in the book. And so when our relationship started, you know, I was very enamored, you know. Mm-hmm. I was 19, I was in college, and, you know, he was great, you know, he's a great guy. And so he helped me financially when I needed help in that way. He was very supportive. He, you know, had my best interest at heart. All of those things, he validated me, right? And he made me feel good about myself at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, I clung to that as tight as I could. And I remember my grandmother saying when she found out how much older he was than I, she said, you know, you're looking for a father figure. And I was so upset with her because I'm like, no, I'm not looking for a father figure. Like, I really love him. I want to be with him. You know, and it wasn't literally until my fourth hospitalization, I was released from the hospital, and I was journaling. I do a lot of journaling, which is how I got the basis for most of the book. And mm-hmm. in the journal, I remember writing, something traumatic happened between he and I won't tell that either because it's in the book. And it's in the book. So I remember writing, and I'm like, he was supposed to love me. He was supposed to protect me. He was supposed to provide for me. All of these things. And when I read it back to myself in my right mind, I was like, I literally said to myself, Kristen, he's not your daddy. He's your man. And that's how I came up with the title of the book, He Wasn't My Daddy. And I really, like, it took all of that time. I mean, we were, you know, in each other's lives for about 8-9 years. It took all of that time for me to realize that I had a void. Up until that point, I did not know that I was a fatherless daughter. I knew my father wasn't there, but I thought that it didn't matter. I thought I didn't care. because he left when I was about four. It matters. It matters. It made me realize that your father really is the one who teaches you and shows you what your intimate relationships with a man is supposed to be like. You know, how a man is supposed to treat you, how a man is supposed to court you. If you don't have that guidance and that example, you kind of go in blindly, and you figure it out as you go along. And I think we as women all know that that's very dangerous.
It's dangerous.
It's very dangerous because, you know, you're kind of playing Russian roulette with your heart. And so that's one way that, you know, not having a father figure is very impactful for a woman, is her intimate relationships with a man, really critical. Another way is her level of self-respect and self-esteem. And those things are really important because it influences our decision-making. And I do workshops that center around self-esteem. And one thing that I always connect self-esteem with is decision making. They go hand in hand. And I like to say that our decision making is an outward reflection of how we feel about ourselves. You know, when we feel good about ourselves, we make decisions that are beneficial to us. When we don't feel so good about ourselves, we make decisions that can often be detrimental to us. So those are a few things that I note in my book as to how, you know, you can identify some of the traits of a fatherless daughter.
Wow. And, you know, and I totally believe that, just like you said, fathers are supposed to teach you certain things about being courted, about being respected. And I think overall, fathers, they really teach their children who they are. If you don't know who you are, you can't be confident. You can't have high self-esteem because you don't know who you are. And you're going through life trying to find yourself or trying to find validation in other people, places, and things. But another, I really want to look at the depression issue. Near the end of the year, a lot of people get depressed. A lot of people get depressed around Valentine's Day. A lot of people, and Valentine's Day is my favorite holiday. I had that dad who came to see. Oh, yes, I'm one of those. My dad was there. I grew up, my parents weren't married, but my father was active and engaged in my life. And my dad was that dad to show up to school for me with balloons. Took me out to dinner almost every Sunday. He opened doors.
Oh,
he was that dad. He was that dad, and as best he could be. I think he and most people around me, including my mom, would say he kind of overindulged me in a lot of areas. A fancy
which is okay.
I'm spoiled. but my view on fathers is a lot different because my dad was there. He was active as much as he could be. But I really want to talk to you about the depression part of things, because whether your dad is there or not, I think across the board there are people who come from perfect homes, broken homes, dysfunctional homes, good homes, who go through depression. And sometimes, you know, we've seen so many suicides. You've even had a couple of suicide attempts yourself, even trying to get through depression. Can you, first of all, tell us a little bit of what depression is like, and then tell us how the people around you can watch and identify and help the situation of a person around them being depressed instead of hindering or causing a person or contributing to a person going into deeper depression?
Wow, that's a lot.
I know.
You know, it's really hard to describe what depression is like for somebody who's never experienced it, because it's really tough. There are a few excerpts in my book where I talk about, I kind of try to paint a picture for what I felt like when I was suffering from depression and when I would have breakdowns. And I would have them quite often, actually. And so I try to, as best possible, paint that picture. So I'm going to try to find, before we end our conversation, one of the excerpts from the book, just to kind of put it in words as to what I felt like. But before I do that, I can say that I felt like there was no means to an end. You know, I felt mm-hmm. like I was not going to ever be okay. And the suicide piece comes in when you don't see any hope for things getting better. You know, I've heard a lot of people say, you know, I would never commit suicide. I would never take my life. Nothing's that bad. But until you've been in that situation and you've experienced those feelings, you can't speak to that. And that's my personal belief. Sometimes,
that's,
you know,
true
when you're
in every situation.
Absolutely. When you're diagnosed with clinical depression, oftentimes it's actually a chemical imbalance, and that's what it was for me. And so I talk about in the book how my first hospitalization was at Southern Maryland Hospital here in Clinton, Maryland. And when I went in there, I was just kind of blown away. I'm a school teacher. I graduated from Spelman, 10 in my class. I graduated from George Mason with a perfect 4.0. You know, I bought a house when I was 23, I think, 22 or 23. You know, so my life had been pretty good, you know. I came from a good family, all those kinds of things. And so for me to walk in a psych ward was very, very self-defeating for me, because all I remember thinking was, like, how did I get here? You know, this is not the trajectory that I painted for my life, you know. And so I felt really, really bad about that. And in the book I talk about how, you know, I realized that psych wards and mental hospitals and places of that nature is not just people that you assume are crazy, you know, people that quote-unquote look crazy or people that are walking around on the streets yelling. It's all kinds of people there. You wouldn't even, you know what I mean? And I've met some very nice people there, you know, people with great jobs, people with substantial incomes, people with children and husbands, you know, and you'd be surprised how life has a way of bringing out sometimes the worst in you, you know. And so for me, when I felt at my lowest, I genuinely did not want to be here anymore. I did not want to face life. I didn't want to deal with my problems. I didn't think that they were going to go away. I would sit on my bathroom floor. I would cry relentlessly. I would Google ways to kill myself that weren't going to be too painful, because I'm a forward thinker, so I'm always thinking. I'm always thinking. You know, and a few times I sat in my garage and I turned my car on and I said, you know, this is going to be the day, you know. And so that's how bad it got for me, you know. And everybody has varying degrees of depression, you know, as it relates to, you know, family and friends and loved ones being there to support you. Somebody asked me a question maybe a month or so ago, and they said, well, you know, I have someone that I'm very close to that's suffering from depression, and I don't know what to do to help them. It seems like nothing I do works. And, you know, from my personal experience, I'm not a psychiatrist, a psychologist. I'm speaking from my personal experience. There wasn't anything that anybody could do to help me. You know, I felt like I was that far gone. What was comforting was knowing that there were people who never left my side, like my mother. She never left my side. Whenever I was in the hospital, she was right there, you know. I talk about an instance where I was in a hospital called Skyland Trail, and it's a mental health facility, and it's in Atlanta. So I had to leave my job, go to Atlanta, and I had to fly there the within one day. Because, you know, they have to admit you, all of these things. You do an interview to get there. So my mother and I flew to Atlanta within 24 hours, and my mother was on four flights within a 24-hour period just to make sure that I got to Atlanta safely, that I was checked into the facility. And then she came right back to D.C. on two more flights so that she could be back home for work the next day. You know, and so even though I talk about my mother – and I, how our relationship was a little testy in the beginning in some of my earlier years, for me, seeing that level of support from her was so very comforting, because it made me feel like I wasn't alone, You know, mm-hmm. a lot of time when people are going through things like that, they feel like they're the only one. They feel like nobody cares about them, that, you know, nobody would care if they were dead. I felt that way. As many people mm-hmm. that are in my life who constantly tell me that they care and that they love me, I felt very alone, and I felt that if I were dead, everybody's life would move on and nobody would care. I felt like they would cry at the funeral, and 2 weeks later they would be back to normal, and my pain would be mm-hmm. over, and that's what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. so I'm not sure if that is impactful enough to really help people understand what it felt like, but mm-hmm. that's how I felt. I'm working on a workbook now, actually, to accompany my book. And the workbook is going to talk about self-esteem. It's going to have a section about mental health, so specifically depression, anxiety, and suicide. And then it's going to have a section about relationships. So it's a three-part workbook. And I came up with a system to help people cope with depression in the moment, for
wow.
instance, when you're having a breakdown. And I came up with this because I've been in so much therapy, Makaysha, like you couldn't even imagine. And so, you know, I would go to my appointments and, you know, a lot of times, if people have never been there, it's hard for them to really tell you what to do and how to deal with it. So I like mm-hmm. to think of this workbook as a practical approach, things that your therapist wouldn't tell you, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I came up with this acronym. It's how to get through depressive episodes. It's called ECT, enact critical thinking. It's hard to do, but, you know, I flesh it out in the workbook, and there's about five different steps that I found work for me. And, again, this is not research-based. This is not, you know, I'm not a therapist or a psychiatrist. This is what works for me over my five-year course of dealing with this illness. And so mm-hmm. in the workbook, I'll list out all of the steps that you take in order to kind of get through those moments. But one thing that I will say, and this is in the book, it was very comforting for me to know, and this has helped me a lot of nights, that time and feelings are fleeting. And that sounds like such a simple statement. But the reason that was so impactful for me was because, again, when you think about committing suicide, it's because you feel like there's no end to your pain. You feel like as long as you live, you're going to have this pain, and it's not going to go away. So I need to end this pain. I need to get out of this misery, and I cannot wait for this pain to be over. That's the gist of how you feel. But when you really and truly understand that time and feelings are fleeting, what you come to understand is that your feelings, even if they're miserable, they will change. You know, I was talking to a young woman who was suicidal, and she was slitting her wrist. And so she was a cutter. And I asked her, I said, okay, once you cut, the moment after you cut, do you feel any different? She said, yeah. I said, that's because your mood shifted, you know. And that was important for her to understand because it allowed her to see cognitively that my mood will often shift throughout periods of the day, every hour, every minute. Our moods constantly shift. And when we recognize mm-hmm. that somebody who's very suicidal, we understand that this feeling of wanting to end my life because this pain is never going to end, we understand that at some point this pain will end, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that takes away that thought that this pain is not going to ever go anywhere. And so then what mm-hmm. you've done is you've allowed yourself to see, okay, so my feelings will shift. So then the question becomes, what do I do while I feel like this? And so that's kind of what I spell out in my ECT steps in the workbook. So hopefully that will be helpful to people. And see, as many therapists as I've gone to, and as great as some of them were, they weren't able to get me to that level of thinking because they had never experienced that.
Right. So, well, exactly. I never thought about it that way. They haven't gone through it, so they can tell you the clinical side of things, but
exactly.
they may not necessarily be able to tell you what to do day to day to help you through your process. Now, you have been extremely transparent about, you are very transparent in the book. You've been very transparent in this interview.
And one of the things that I've had an opportunity to do is I had a chance to look at your Pearls of Wisdom. I think they are so awesome. You could take each one of these Pearls of Wisdom, post them on the wall, put them in your bathroom, in your car, in your wallet, make little bitty cards to take them around you, to take them around with you, because they make so much sense. They make a lot. It's almost like, you know how old people, you know, I'm from the South, so we always say mother wit. It's like that mothering wisdom. I know you're not a mom, but it's that wisdom.
And I was going to say it's funny because I don't have any children.
Right. But you ran the gamut. I mean, you even put just common sense things in the Pearls of Wisdom. Girl, you need to make some cards a deck and sell them.
And sell, really?
Because, yes, you should. You seriously, because not only do you put practical information in them, but some of this stuff is scriptural. One of them is God is a jealous God. When you put things and people before him, he will surely take them away. Do you know how many
I learned
times
the hard way.
People, yeah, you know, a lot
yeah,
of times because and I think a lot of us do, whether it's a job, whether it's a mate, a lot of the time, I mean, even as a wife, I know that I crave my husband more than I crave God, and finding
Absolutely.
That balance in the relationship to really serve and please God, I should automatically please my husband instead of trying to please him, and I'm not pleasing God. And it's not that your mate is always requiring you to do those things. It's just the mindset. You want the relationship. You want the job. You want the car. You want all of these things more than you want God, and he knows.
And you know what I realized, and this happened with my ex and I, Lenny, and I talk about it in the book, actually. When you get to a place where you want something so much and you put it before God, that's a clear indication that you're feeling a void. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, for me, and I say this in the book, I made Lenny my God, you know,
mm-hmm.
And that's a very, very dangerous place to be. It will
mm-hmm.
end you in the hospital like me, you know. It's not something that I take lightly at all, because I've realized just how. And I talk about even my run-ins with the law as a result of my making this particular person so very
mm-hmm.
important to me. I put him on a pedestal. And I talk about
mm-hmm.
in the book how when you put someone on a pedestal, you don't leave them any room to fall. And so when they fall,
mm-hmm.
you're devastated. And,
mm-hmm.
and we can't expect humans, people, not to fall. You know, when I was writing the introduction, I love this part, and I'll read a quick excerpt. It says, I was his baby. He took me under his wing and protected me. He was never supposed to hurt me or lie to me. I had high expectations of him. He was supposed to be my daddy, my family, the one man in my life that would love and protect me forever. He was supposed to cherish me and put me first. I trusted him completely, giving him my all and removing all barriers surrounding my heart, because he said he would never hurt or forsake me. Daddies don't do that to their little girls. However, there was just one little problem. He wasn't my daddy. You should never feel that way about a man. Ever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and when you,
yep,
again, when you put that much,
mm-hmm.
yeah, he was my whole existence. And so that was a problem, you know, so that's where that pearl came from, that pearl of wisdom. And I kept trying to figure out, I said, well, nothing else in my life was going wrong, right? My money was fine,
mm-hmm.
my house was fine, my career was, everything was fine except for this man.
Mm-hmm.
And I could not figure out, and I kept praying and praying and praying. And finally, I'm like, you don't worship anything else but him.
Mm.
You don't worship your house. You know, people would ask me, why are you so depressed? You have this, you have that. I didn't care about those things. I was thankful for them, but they didn't define who I was. I didn't worship them. And so maybe God protected them for that reason. I didn't put those things before him. But the one thing I put before God, he sure took it away.
Oh, yeah, because he'll get whatever out of your life people, places, things, ideas, anything, that, especially if you're trying to pray, you're trying to do the right thing, and you have a solid foundation, God, once you're His, He's going to hold on to you until you decide you don't want to be His anymore. But as long as you're His, He's going to keep taking those things out of your life so that you'll stay His. He's gonna help you to be His, and I think that is so important. Whether you're single, whether you're married, your mate should never become before God. It should not. Your mate should not become your idol. You should not crave your mate more than you crave God, and that is just. Like I said, girl, take those, get them printed on some cards, and sell them. That people can put in their wallets, pencil the wall on their pegboards at work, because they make so much sense. And a lot of the times, the people around us don't always know what to say to us to touch us. One of
I
them
had
was
that experience.
Allow yourself. You know, and you have this now, and you're sharing it with other people. Keep sharing it, because you even said allow yourself to feel the pain. Oftentimes we are in so much pain we want to escape it. Pain is an inevitable part of our healing process. In order to heal, if you get cut, it's painful. It starts to itch. It starts to bug you. If you have a cut on your arm, it's a painful process. And
but the more you
pick
up that scab, the longer it's going to take to heal, right?
Exactly. Oh, those, like I said, that's what you need to do with them. We
consider that just for you.
That's
because, you know, when you go
that.
To therapy, they'll tell you to use your positive affirmations. You know, that's one of the things they say. The problem is you can't access that stuff when you're really depressed. It's really hard to use your coping skills and all. What coping skills? You know, that's when you're really depressed. You're not really a logical thinker. You know, so that's why I wanted to come up with a system that didn't necessarily account for that, because it needs to meet you where you are.
Make sure you put these in that new book.
I found the excerpt in the book where this is one of them. There's many actually in here, because like you said, the book is very transparent, and I tried to pour my heart out. But there's a couple, and if we have time, I can read a couple little pieces to answer your question more fully.
We have about 2 minutes left.
Okay, let me read one.
Left, so whatever you can get in that time. Okay.
Perfect. So this is about how depression felt for me. Miss Has It All Together was literally falling apart. Unbathed, improperly dressed, hair matted to my scalp because it hadn't been combed, sitting on any low-level surface Indian style with hands in my lap, bowed head, a steady back-and-forth motion, rocking, accompanied with an uninterrupted hum that went on for extended periods of time. I could not think. Nothing made sense. I just knew heaven was better than earth, so I didn't understand why God was ignoring my request to take me away from earth and allow me to escape the torture and simply dwell with him in heaven. Anything would have been better than where and how I was currently living. So that's one of the excerpts in the book that kind of gives a snippet of how I felt in those really, really depressed moments, and that's in chapter 15, which is called It's Been Too Hard Living, I'm Ready to Die. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah, but you got to read the book. It's so much great information, and for you to have gone through it and be still standing here to share it, that's a testimony. And, you know, people say there's no testimony without a test, and you put that.
Yeah.
We have about 60 seconds left. Please tell us what you have going on, website information.
Well, I'm really excited about my launch party that's coming out. The book came out in September, but I waited a little bit to celebrate officially the release, and so if anybody's listening that's in D.C., I'm having a huge launch party on January 18th. From 4 to 9 p.m., and all of that information is on my website. You can register and buy tickets for the event on my website, and the tickets are only $15, which comes with admission and a copy of the book. My website is my name, and my name is Kristin L. Mitchell, but it's K-R-I-S-T-I-N. I saw it written somewhere with the E. So it's Kristin, K-R-I-S-T-I-N, L. Mitchell, M-I-T-C-H-E-L-L.com, or you can Google He Wasn't My Daddy and the website will come up. So the book is available for purchase in paperback for $15 on my website. You can also get it on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com for any electronic device. So it's available in ebook format as well.
Well, thank you so much, Kristen, for coming on the show and telling your story. Thank everyone who dialed in to listen tonight. This has been Tribal Wisdom Radio. This is Makaysha Dorsey signing off, and I'll be here next week, and I hope to see you then. Good night.
Thank you. Good night.